briefly. I am Dave Taffet, and I'm here in the studio with Ron Landis. The late Patty Fink is late.
She's going to be really late. We won't see her until next week.
And she'll be back next week?
Because
she's going out to California. When is she going to California?
I think Tuesday.
Oh, okay. So this is a midweek wedding she's doing. Mm-hmm. Here's what Patty did. Patty registered herself as a church. Now, Patty and I married a couple who's been on our show several times, Rafiq and
Cannon. Cannon Flowers.
But they had gotten a real wedding.
Right. You all just did ceremony.
That was just one of those one of those ceremonies, you know, a local ceremony where, you know, it was your typical the Baptist and the Jew married the Methodist and the Muslim.
It was very typical.
But this one's a real wedding, and she's the real real
officiating person.
Yeah. And she's registered in California now, and she can do weddings.
Mm-hmm.
Our guest today, Doc was busy chatting on the phone and chatting and put her on. Okay. Hi, Dolores. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Great. Oh, and the sound is perfect.
I'm glad.
Yeah, we're never sure here at our studio. Dolores DeLuce is the author of the new book, My Life, A Four-Letter Word. And it's a fabulous book. I've been reading it this week. She was disowned by her own family and moved out to California, formed her own new family that included people like the Cockettes and Divine and a whole bunch of other people, a whole bunch of gay people. We're going to be talking all about all those kinds of things. What I wanted to start with here was my favorite odd question that came out of the book. Why did so many queers end up in your bed?
That's what everybody wanted to know. You know, I think it had a lot to do with the times and the drugs we were taking back in the 70s. I think that was the major factor. But I don't know. I've always had, well, my roommate Marshall was one of many 11 roommates I shared a flat in San Francisco with in the mid-70s, said I had fag attraction. And it's true. I don't know what it was about me. I wasn't one of those fag hags that ran around trying to conquer gay men. It was just never on my agenda. But so many of my, you know, boyfriends were guys that were just really close friends, you know, like my brothers and family members, and then very often it would slide into a sexual relationship and a lover relationship. And sometimes it was just a one-night stand, and sometimes it lasted longer than that. And, you know, and this has been, I remember once going to Maui with my daughter at the time, who was only 4 or 5 years old. I think it was 1974. And there was mostly all straight people on this little island. Next thing I know, the only two gay boys on the island were like coming on, and coming out to me, first of all, and then coming on to me.
They were like, but why coming on to you? I get it with the friendship.
Yeah.
And you're saying it was the drugs. I don't want you reporting what these drugs were to places like Focus on the Family, because they might just take those drugs and say, you see, we can cure gay people.
Yeah. No. I just think that, you know, it actually, if anything, it made us more queer than ever.
Okay.
No, you know, the loosening up drugs, you know, like the Quaaludes in the 70s were quite good for allowing one's inhibitions to, be put aside. So I wonder if I would have had a sex life at all if it wasn't
for the gay men.
Yeah, exactly. I had my share of straight men, believe me.
Oh, okay.
They were never as fabulous as friends and lovers, you know. And I think it was more important for me to feel intimacy with people I felt closeness to, you know. And so many of those lovers remained my friends after there was no longer the physical attraction or whatever, you know, like reverted back to our friendship. You know, most of those men remained my best friends, you know, until death did us part, you know. I mean, and they continue to be even from the other side to this day. And I have
That's very lesbian of you.
Well, I am. You know, like my best friend and lover, Tommy Pace. I have a whole chapter about him in the book. He was an Italian-American like me, and he was very funny and performer. He was with the Gay Men's Theater Collective. He used to always say that I was a fag trapped in a woman's body and that he was a lesbian trapped in a faggot's body. And that was the attraction between us, you know.
Well, for those who don't know you, you are a performer, dancer, singer, actress, but you're from Jersey originally, is that correct?
Yes.
We're in Jersey.
Jersey girl.
All
right, Paterson, New Jersey.
Paterson, my father's from Nutley.
You're kidding.
No, I grew up in Yonkers. Yeah, I grew up in Yonkers, but I've been here actually 35 years this week.
Wow.
Yeah, but but my father's from Nutley.
I know Nutley, all those little towns in New Jersey. There's so many of them. Mm-hmm.
So what took you to from Jersey to L.A. or to San Francisco?
My oppressive Italian-American family, my father, fear of my father discovering my, extracurricular activities. I was always a wild child, you know. I think I was a rebel from birth. I don't know. It goes back to very young. I was always defiant and, didn't buy into whatever they were telling me that I was supposed to buy into from as far back as I can remember. And then, of course, when I started to come of age, you know, teenage years, sex was totally, you know, Italian Catholic girls are supposed to be virgins, you know, on their wedding night. And I never went for that double standard. While all my male cousins were out screwing around, I was supposed to be good and clean the house, you know. So that started with that, and then it got more outrageous. And I knew that if I didn't get out of town, eventually my father would probably kill me if he ever caught me doing some of the stuff I was doing. But even in high school, it's so funny because I graduated in June 1963, and there were a handful of gay, obviously gay men, and a few gay women in my high school, but they were all in the closet, even though, you know, it was pretty clear that some of them were, you know, queens and what have you, you know. And for some reason, even those boys and I always had this bond, you know. I don't know, I always gravitated toward, you know, the unconventional in society, I guess, as far back. And I realized as I got older and I, you know, ended up living in this totally counterculture gay community and started like in Venice Beach and then moved into San Francisco, that I was just as queer as anyone, you know. And that, I think that was always the attraction right from the get-go, even though I sort of identified as a heterosexual for a long period of time. Mm-hmm. I was always the queer girl, you know, underneath.
And the gay community or the queer community has been growing. There are all kinds of new categories. Zach Walls, who started that scouting group, Scouting for All, is it called?
No, that's a different one. But Zach Walls is the
Scouts for Equality.
I don't know exactly what the name of the group is, but he is the one who has two mothers.
Yeah, he has two moms.
Right.
And when I was talking to him last year, you know, he said, you know, I don't want you to add another letter for me, but I'm definitely part of the gay community. And he's straight. He's completely straight.
Yes.
And do you know what I just heard about him this week? He just got a job as a White House intern.
Oh, that's awesome.
Wow.
He's working in the White House. So,
awesome.
Yeah. He's great.
Are you familiar with Alicia Abbott and her book, Fairyland, A Memoir of My Father?
No.
These awards. She's the same age as my daughter. Mm-hmm. And we all were living in San Francisco in the Haight-Ashbury. And my daughter was born in 1970, and so was Alicia. And she had a gay dad. Her mother passed away when she was two, and her father moved with her. They were from Atlanta to San Francisco and raised her in the same community. And we were talking, we've become friends over our books because they kind of parallel the same lines, although she was the daughter of living, growing up in this gay community, and I had a daughter, you know. But for some reason, I never, like, met her father, but we had all these mutual friends. And as a young woman, she told me the same thing. She goes, even though I'm straight, I have a husband, I have two children, I feel very queer because I grew up in this family.
Right.
You know?
Right. So there are all these odd pieces that are coming together, and our community is just growing and growing. So, you know, you were always part of our community, just not one with a letter.
I have the B. I say you can use it. Either I'm a bitch or a bi or whatever.
I was just gonna.
I'm the B in LGBTIQ, whatever. I getting with the I and the Q stand. Since they added them.
I wanted to talk about some of the people that you created your family with. Your actual family actually disowned you.
They did. My father did. I mean, my mother had to go along being the good Italian wife. You know, she couldn't, go against my father's wishes. I had a sister who was just a year younger than me, and then I had a younger brother at the time who was only 8 years old. And, my father was not a bad man. You know, he was a sweetheart, really, underneath. But, you know, he had all these brothers and sisters who were older than him, and there was a lot of pressure, you know, like, you know, they were very uneducated. They were immigrants. They came from southern Italy. You know, it was all of that they say. You know, they never read a book. They barely spoke, you know. I mean, my father did learn English, you know, and he could read and write, but there was no emphasis on education, and so I always stood out in that sense. And that, you know, my mom worked in a factory, my father was a fruit and vegetable peddler until the supermarket chains came in the 50s, and then he became a manager at the ShopRite, you know, produce manager. So they just were very working class, and they didn't ever got me, you know. It was always difficult for them, and so I just thought for some reason that my dad. Like, when I finally did meet my daughter's father, I fell in love with him. We were living together almost a year before I got pregnant. I thought that maybe underneath they would accept it, but when I came out and told them, you know, that I was pregnant with this black man's child, my father lost it completely and started cursing at me, calling me a nigger-loving whore and all these horrible things, and hung up on me, told me I was dead to the family. And that lasted for about 2 years. And finally, he broke down and realized that he was going to lose his daughter forever if he didn't bend, you know. And he did, you know, to his credit. And it took a lot of years of our battling. I mean, you know, he was a Republican, right?
One of those.
Italian working class immigrant, but voting, you know, Republican. So we battled on every front you could imagine. Mm-hmm. But finally, you know, there was like a great reconciliation in our lives, especially toward the end of his life, you know, great healing between us. But he did accept my daughter after a couple of years. Okay. Yeah, but it was difficult because I was living alone. I was I was abandoned by my daughter's father as well, so I had no family. And the gay men and women that were my friends, you know, just became my family. I mean, they were the ones that helped me raise my daughter. I mean, in my book, you know, you say you're reading it, I really pay homage to this community for saving my life in a way, because otherwise I would have had a very lonely, isolated life.
When I was reading that part, what I was thinking was that was back in the 70s.
Right. Yeah,
when it was very hard. Like, Laurent is a gay dad. They went out of their way to have an interracial baby. and you did, because you were planning that if the surrogate that you found was black, then Danny would be the sperm donor. But since the surrogate you found was white, that you'd be the sperm donor.
Right,
so,
right.
And what's very funny is Laurent is the actual dad, but the baby looks more like, she's not a baby anymore. She's five.
She's five.
But she looks more like the one who's not the father.
Oh, you know what else is funny? Her biological mother is white, but she's Italian.
Oh. Okay.
Oh, great. But your daughter is actually like my daughter. She's half Italian, half black.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Oh, that's great.
So, but what I was thinking was, you know, back in the 70s, a lot of states it was illegal for gays to adopt. In fact, most states.
Yes.
There was no such thing as surrogacy.
No.
So, unless you were left a child that was in your family, gays weren't being parents then. And so your situation was one of those, you came into their lives and it's okay, I can be a parent now.
Yeah, and it was great because, you know, that's why they were such great babysitters. I mean, it's like, there are all these people that were naturally loving, you know, had all these great nurturing qualities, and they were able to shower them upon my daughter, you know, who got a lot of greatness, and, you know, her spirit is so strong and beautiful, and I think so much of that came, you know, from these special people that helped me raise her, you know, her aunties and uncles. She's off in Kazakhstan right now. I just put her on an airplane yesterday. She's a singer, jazz and blues singer now, and she goes all over the world and performs. So she got a 5-day gig in Kazakhstan, of all places, with an all-black band that she sings with. And they just flew them business class, and she checked in with me at 1 in the morning, said, I just landed in Frankfurt, Germany. We have a 3-hour layover, and then we're flying into Kazakhstan. So, you know, I raised this wonderful daughter, but I think so much of the influence of that community really benefit to her, you know.
As you know, I felt like you were writing it almost like, well, wasn't this wonderful? And I was reading it as, well, of course that happened.
Yeah.
Of course, that was the most obvious thing for gay people to do in the 70s. We adopted other people's kids.
Right. I know a few people that had their own, but usually they were like bisexual men that had been in a relationship with a woman and then birth, and then somehow, you know, ended up parenting the child.
But that was only if the other parent absolutely didn't want the kid, because very few judges were going to give custody to the gay parent at the time.
There's that movie that Alan Ball was in about the gay couple that wanted to adopt this kid that was what's the word when they Down syndrome. Did you see that film?
No, I hadn't seen
it. Yeah, about a year ago. I can't remember the name.
I can't remember either.
Indy, and he had he and his lover fought the courts to get try to adopt this kid whose mother abandoned him when she was a junkie and abused him, and oh, the poor kid. It was so tragic. And this was based on a true story in the 70s, and how the court system refused the men the right to adopt this kid, and he ended up dying in the streets because every time they put him in a foster home, he was neglected and abused. And when he didn't go back to these two gay men who'd become his fathers, he lost all hope, you know. And so painful.
I know here in Texas, every time we happen to have, you might not have heard around the country, but we have a bunch of Republicans here in office.
and just a few.
Well, every time, you know, one of them gets a bug up his butt to, gay people shouldn't be adopting. Child Protective Services runs to the legislature and says, who the hell do you think is adopting all of our special needs, especially kids?
Exactly. Yeah, nobody wants them. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, it's amazing, you know, because there is, you know, gay people have a lot of compassion and love, and the fact that they can't have children, I mean, it's sad. Well, at least we're coming a long way, and yet at the same time, you know, it's like, you know, what is it, 3 steps forward, 2 steps forward, you know, you have all that backlash against. Mm-hmm. I heard that whole thing at the beginning of the show there, they were talking about the Koch brothers, you know. Was that on your show?
Yeah,
I know. Oh, God.
Okay, Dolores, we need to take a break. This is our first break. The time just flew. Laron is signaling me. I'm usually the one signaling him. We're talking to Dolores DeLuce. Just 2 minutes. We're talking to Dolores DeLuce. Her book is My Life, a Four-Letter Word. We'll be back right after this.
Want to find out about upcoming events at KNON? Want to see pictures from past events or need information about the station? Then you need to like the official KNON Facebook page. It's easy to find. Just go to facebook.com/KNON893. It's the KNON 89.3 FM station-produced page for Facebook. It's the easiest way to keep up with what's going on here at KNON. Like us and share with your friends today. That's facebook.com/KNON893. Accept no substitutions.
Hi, I'm Cleve Jones, and you're listening to Lambda Weekly on 89.3 KNON FM.
And this is Lambda Weekly. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Ron Landis. Late Patty Fink will be back with us next week. She's very late again this week. She's here with a detour through California to with her new, she's a newly ordained minister and is doing weddings.
So whenever you decide to get
hitched, you decide to get married, if you want to get married in California, Patty would be happy to be your reverend. Did she say what she's calling herself?
She didn't.
Okay.
So I don't know if she's established that yet.
She named her church. Our guest today is Dolores DeLuce. Her book is My Life, a Four-Letter Word, Confessions of a Counterculture Diva. Dolores, on the cover of the book, It says 25 cents.
That's the price it would have been if I had published it in the 50s.
Yes.
It's
okay.
Based on that, you know, kind of that vintage Pulp Fiction look of books.
I like it.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I have a collection of lesbian books that from that era that have the most hysterical titles, like My Wife the Dyke and Satan was Lesbian, and I have a dozen of them that a friend of mine found in the trash. And I put them in plastic, you know, pockets in a shower curtain for many years. And now they're in my hallway because they were getting moldy inside the shower.
Those are classics.
Are classic. And every time I have a delivery guy or somebody, you know, the sparkless man come up and they look at the wall of the books of shame. You know? It's so funny. They think, who is this crazy woman? Yeah. You know?
Speaking of crazy women, when you moved out to San Francisco from New Jersey.
Well, actually, I moved first to Venice. Well, first to L.A., and then to Venice Beach. The first 3 years of my daughter's life, we were in Venice. And then that's where I met Divine in 1972 and at a show in San Francisco. She was performing with the Coquettes, and we became fast friends. Then he came down to Venice with an entourage and stayed with me. They came for a weekend and stayed a month. Mm-hmm. They loved being on the beach so much. And then afterwards, Divine kind of introduced me to the Coquettes and said, you should put Dolores in one of your shows. She's really funny. And the next thing I know, I was moving to San Francisco with my daughter and everything packed in my VW Bug and moved up there to start my career on the stage.
Okay, so what I wanted to ask, first of all, are the Coquettes still performing?
Well, actually, two of the original Coquettes, Grumbly Coldwyn and Pam Tent, actually three of them, and Rumi, are working with a new theater group in San Francisco. What's it called? I think the Hippodrome Play or something like that. They've been doing reenactments of all the old Coquette shows and new, you know, with some new lyrics and music by Scrumley. Scrumley wrote all the music to a lot of my shows, and he was one of the original Coquettes, as well as Sweet Pam and Rumi. And so, so I guess some of them are still performing.
Okay. And the reason I didn't know was it's been years since they've been here.
Right. They don't call themselves the Coquettes anymore. Right. Many of the Coquettes are no longer with us.
Right. Okay, so explain to our audience here in Dallas, have you ever seen them, Laron?
The Coquettes?
Yeah.
No.
Okay. And they have performed here, and I can't remember when it was, but I guess it's a while ago. Explain who they are.
Well, they were a gender bender theater group that evolved out of the community in the late 60s, back in the Haight-Ashbury hippie days. An actor from New York, Hibiscus, who was a total freak that went out to the West Coast. And, you know, he kind of started the first, he was one of the original Coquettes, and people just gravitated. He was very charismatic, and they started doing, you know, just like events in Golden Gate Park, you know, with the free concerts. And then the next thing they were doing was midnight shows at the Palace Theater in San Francisco. And basically the first Coquette show was just a chorus line of boys wearing big hoop skirts with no nothing underneath and doing a can-can revealing, you know, going on stage nude and, you know, just stuff like that, like after the midnight movies. And eventually they really evolved into a great company of wonderful theater artists, you know, the sets, costumes, performers, writers, and they had a reign of several years where they had a lot of popularity. They went to New York, and they flopped in New York because the New Yorkers were expecting, you know, a polished theatrical event on Broadway.
Right.
And the Cockettes were not that. They were pretty outrageous and wild and free and, you know. So.
I'm surprised that they were not successful, though, in a place like Greenwich Village. Because that's where they belong, not Broadway.
The problem was they did a big, you know, the people that promoted them took them right to Broadway, you know, put them on a big set, and their sets were dwarfed. There's a lot of information about their personal history in David Weissman's film, Les Cockettes. Are you familiar with that documentary?
Yeah.
And as well as Pam Tent's book, My Fabulous Life as a Cockette, both very great in terms of telling the actual history of the Cockettes, you know, and how they rose to fame and then how they fell. And there was a lot of drugs, you know, there were a lot of deaths and overdoses and people, you know, fading away. So by the time I came into the company, they were actually not even performing under the name of the Cockettes at that point. They were just doing shows randomly, the remaining core that were functioning, you know, like Scrumbly and Sweet Pam and Pristine Condition and John Flowers, and you know, there was quite a, you know, a group of them that were still very vital and doing shows, and that's when I met them and then did the very last show at the Palace Theater in 1973. It was a Cockette version of Cinderella, where Goldie Glitters, one of the Cockettes, played Cinderella. She was a 6 foot tall drag queen, not the most attractive girl, but and she was my friend, and then Divine and she were friends, and the next thing I know, I was like in this show as a dancing pumpkin. That's the opening chapter of my book, and how I was like, I took acid on the night of the performance, which everybody seemed to do at the Cockette show, and did this whole modern dance routine in a pumpkin costume and fell on my ass on stage and couldn't get up. It was hysterical, and the audience loved me even more for it, you know.
Well, so, I want to talk a little bit about the man who you just said introduced you to the Cockettes, and that is Divine. Now, for most of my, I would probably say most mainstream America would recognize Divine as...
You're not mainstream, Laurent.
Well, not anymore.
right.
But would recognize that name as associated with John Waters movies. And for me, was, you know, I think the first time I saw him was in the movie Pink Flamingos. Woo, what a movie. Anyway, but I want to read a quote that you said, and that is... talking about Divine, and it is, when Divine took the stage in her foot-high bouffant wig that sat inches above a human's natural hairline and her painted cat eyes, I immediately recognized her as my long-lost alien mother. Who wouldn't feel that way? Can you elaborate on that? Why?
You know, all right, I grew up with a crazy narcissistic mother who should have been on the stage. She would have been a lot happier than being a mother. And I guess when I met Divine had such a warm and maternal quality. He was so loving, you know, and so I always thought of him as like the mother I wished I had had. But, you know, because he, you know, was such a freak on stage, you know, and his looks and everything, he was like an alien. And I think at some point in the book I talked about in my childhood when I used to, you know, just escape by watching lots and lots of films and TV shows in the 50s on my black and white TV. I always imagined I was an alien in my family because I never felt like I belonged there. And so that I connected that to Divine, like when I spotted Divine, I go, oh, this is my real mother, you know?
Gotcha.
Now, other than in the film Some Like It Hot, was Divine the first drag queen on film?
You know, I don't know if that's the case for sure. I think there was probably drag going on before that. I mean, I know Milton Berle.
It
drag, you know, but, and of course, in the history of theater, Shakespearean theater, men played women's roles, so.
I'm talking more on film, though.
On film, yeah, except if you go back to some of those early.
You know, that's a good question, David.
Yeah, yeah.
That's something we should investigate.
What would be a good reference is The Celluloid Closet. Because he talks about all these incidents of, so I don't really know about that, but Divine was definitely one of the ones, and because of John Waters, you know, and going into Hairspray, started to, you know, get more mainstream recognition, and he even got a male role, a couple of male roles in films, and then ended up, have you seen the new documentary yet that Jeffrey Schwartz did called I Am Divine?
No, I've heard about it. I have not seen it yet.
I'm in that. He interviewed me in the documentary, which is great. Yeah, and it tells a lot about his career and his history and his background. And John, you know, I just saw John a few weeks ago. He was here in L.A. on his new book tour, and I'm trying to get him to give me a quote for my next book because he never got around to reading the manuscript for the first one. I was hitting him up then, so maybe he'll give me one for the second book.
Well, he should.
I'm hoping. I guilt tripped him enough.
Now, through Divine, you became friendly with John Waters.
No, I didn't know. I'd say that's not the truth.
Okay.
I knew John, but we weren't good buddies or anything. Mm-hmm. You know, he was busy doing his thing, and he really only wanted to work with his crew from Baltimore. Divine used to ask him, why don't you put Dolores in one of our movies? And he went, no, yeah. But, you know, I knew him. And as John has aged in the last two or three times I've seen John at different events, he's actually so much warmer and open and sweet. You know, we've all been through a lot. You know, we've lost so many of our dearest loves in our lives. And, you know, and I think it really softened John up. And he's very grateful for his success and, you know, can't even believe it sometimes about how the mainstream has accepted him. You know, and his work over all these years.
Mm-hmm. I've always wondered, because I know that Divine, from what I've read, he was an actor. Did he have a problem with the drag queen label?
No. Not in those days. I mean, you know, he was a gay boy, you know, who didn't fit in with his school. He was bullied, you know, and when he met John Waters and that gang of freaks from Baltimore, they all kind of formed their own family, and John, you know, was interested in making films, and Divine was his, you know, muse, I guess.
And the reason why I ask that is because, you know, so when you have somebody like Divine who becomes such a big character, larger than life character, people have a hard time separating. You know, they're really not like that. They really are acting. You do understand that is an actor.
Yeah, no, he definitely was not a drag queen who wanted to live in drag. He was not at all interested in being a woman, you know. I mean, just a gay man who liked, you know, the stage and the screen, and he wanted to be a movie star. I mean, that was his thing. And John made him a movie star, you know.
Did he do drag before the movies?
No.
Like in the bars? He didn't do that at all.
I think only, you know, well, I don't know 100% for sure if he did, but he definitely did it with John, and there's a bit of that in the new movie. You should really check that out.
I need to see that.
I will.
I do need to see
that. Am Divine by Jeffrey Schwartz is the same director that did the Vito Russo story, you know, which is another one of his great films about, you know, Vito Russo's life and activism and stuff. There's a lot of great stuff out there right now, and more I think will be coming, I hope. And I think, you know what's so important, and this is one of the things I found when I was on my book tour, I spoke to some audiences at different bookstores in college towns where all these young 20-year-olds and 30-year-olds would come to my readings, and I was so impressed because they didn't know this history, and they were so hungry for it. You know, they'd keep me on the stage for hours, asking me question after question. It really was heartwarming. You know, I felt so glad. I mean, because my book is really a very personal story, but it has enough of the background of that time period to make it, like, historically relevant to people that weren't there and didn't know the struggle, you know?
Well, one of the things that is nice is that there are an awful lot of young people in their 20s who really have no memory of the AIDS crisis. And after our break, we need to take a break now, but after our break, I want to talk a little bit about that and just how it really did affect all of us in our generation.
Okay.
We're talking to Dolores DeLuce. Her book is My Life, a Four-Letter Word, Confessions of a Counterculture Diva. I'm Dave Taffet here in the studio with Laurent Landis. We'll be back with more Lambda Weekly right after I cue
the... Want to find out about upcoming events at KN...
Well, no. That wrong one completely.
If you're going on summer vacation but aren't planning on taking your old car with you, why not donate it to the KNON Vehicle Donation Program? Just call 877-KNON-AUTO and we'll arrange everything from picking up the vehicle to providing the necessary paperwork. Your donation will help support KNON. 877-KNON-AUTO or on the web at knon.org.
Want to see pictures from past events or need information about the station?
Then 3 KNON FM. See you there.
Okay, so Laurent's sitting here laughing at me, and so is Doc. I don't usually run the...
This is what...
Okay, and yeah, and it continues. Okay, so that was the worst commercial break I've done in a long... I don't do the board anymore. And Josh isn't here, our schizophrenic dual personality board operator, Josh and Chris, who's the same person. He's not here this week, so I'm doing the board, I'm doing the computer. You know, I'm used to our 8-track players that to do the ads.
When you're dating yourself there.
No, I'm really not, because we had those 8-track players until about a year and a half ago.
Oh, my goodness.
To do the ads. So that's why everything went off at the same time. We're talking to Dolores DeLuce. Her book is My Life, a Four-Letter Word. It is not really 25 cents, even though it says so on the cover. And it's her story of her life. She has some wonderful stories in it. Here's one that I picked out that I really loved. You met Jane Fonda when her daughter and your daughter were in a play together.
Yeah, that I directed.
And you directed instead of Jane directing, because obviously you know more about show business than she does.
Well, Jane was too busy making Hollywood movies.
Oh, she was too busy.
Yeah, but she did.
It's her daughter.
She did come to the rehearsal every night, dress rehearsal. And
okay.
And her daughter played a male role. She played the Russian count in Can't Take It With You. And Jane would come each night with Shirley Fonda, and she would glue hair on Vanessa's chest, played the Russian count. I had all the girls in drag in the play, because you know how boys are in middle school. Mm-hmm. They didn't want to like be on the theater. It was only a couple. We could only get a couple of boys in the show, so we had to give some of the male roles to the girls.
Mm-hmm. Before the break, we said I want to talk a little bit about having survived the AIDS crisis. And one of the things that you said really struck me, that John Waters has mellowed.
Well, I didn't know him very well back in those early days, because he'd come to San Francisco. I met him at a few parties. Divine introduced us. But he always seemed a little standoffish to me, and I know that Divine said to me, oh, honey, I tried to get John to put you in a movie, but he's always, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So that's really all I knew of John, And then over the years, I've seen him he helped David Weissman with the Coquette movie by being in it and supporting it. And, I was at the premiere of that and, met him there. And in the last few years, I've seen him backstage at different functions, and he's always very open and kind and always, remembers me as soon as he sees me, which kind of surprises me, because I didn't ever think he really knew me very well or paid any attention to me. Mm-hmm. But he's very loving and sweet. And, so I don't know really what he was like, only other than my impression of him back in the early days, We've all get different as we age. I think those of us that have been through, like we were talking about, the loss of all of our dear ones with the AIDS crisis, if we're not bitter, we've grown from the experience.
You know, I went through bitter, I went through angry, went through all those stages. And now when I meet somebody who's like my age, who went through all of that, what we usually talk about is, well, how did you make it through those years?
Yes, yes.
Emotionally, physically, and why are you even alive?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, for me too, you know, I mean, I slept with over 25 men that were HIV positive that are dead today and had unprotected sex with them. And by some miracle, I survived. I didn't get HIV infected.
Right.
And I think it was because basically my sex life sort of changed around 1980. I started meditating and found a guru in my life, and I was sort of struck celibate. Not because I wanted to be, but I was just having a very powerful spiritual experience and didn't find myself needing as much outside attention, you know? And I think that's when the AIDS virus sort of took hold with a lot of my boyfriends, because a lot of them were still out there practicing unsafe sex because they still hadn't made that direct connection, you know, it wasn't guaranteed. Yeah, so it was hard.
I mean, and for me, very directly, a good friend of mine was patient number 25.
Wow.
You know, he was the only thing that they could figure out with him. He contracted Kaposi's sarcoma. He was 25 at the time, and he was the youngest person by 30 years to have ever contracted it at the time, and he was written up in medical books. So, you know, it's not just that we weren't connecting. I was involved in it before we knew anything about it. I mean, we were just kind of looking at it and saying, what's going on here?
Right. So, well, we were calling it gay cancer. I mean, my friend Patrick Cowley, who he did all the disco music for Sylvester. He was one of the early deaths in San Francisco, you know, with Bobby Campbell. And they were right up there in the early 80s, you know.
And Dolores, there's another layer on top of your situation that most other gay men can't say. You had a child in the midst of all this, who also knew these men who were passing away.
Who suffered from the losses too.
Exactly,
she had to have as a
child. About that in the book, how she really there were certain friends when they passed. I mean, she just freaked out. It was so hard for her. Because she was losing these people that were like her...
Her uncles. And
her uncles, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it was something. And she was at that really, you know, kind of tender age, you know, like late teens, early 20s, when everybody was dying around. Mm-hmm. It was painful. It's funny. I was just honored this month. There's a Radical Fairy magazine. I don't know if it's called RFD.
Mm-hmm.
Comes out quarterly. They did a 5-page interview with me with all these beautiful photos from my book, you know, The Gay Widows, which was a performance thing we did. There's about 6 or 7 pictures from the book in there, and it's the special issue that is dedicated to the memory of AIDS, you know, because they're coming on to 40 years, their next issue. And so I was actually very honored to be a part of this quarterly printed magazine, which is beautiful.
It's the other thing that strikes me is it's really only, even though we've had drugs that have controlled the disease since about 1996-97,
and I have a lot of long-term survivor friends.
But it's only recently that we're even talking about the height of the AIDS crisis, meaning
the worst of those
years, and not now. And that we're distancing ourselves from it.
Yeah, yeah, it's true. I think for a long time, people did not want to hear about it. You know, it was like, I remember I was trying to put together an anthology of stories called Gay Widows from all my girlfriends that lived in the community like I did, who some were gay, some were bi, or lesbian women, who were affected just as heavily as the men, the gay men were, you know, from the crisis. And 3 or 4 or 5 of us were writers, and I tried to put an anthology together of our stories, because that's how I was surviving it. I started really writing seriously, you know, writing short stories and stuff. And that was my way of coping, is to keep them alive in memory by writing stories about them, you know. And that was the very beginnings of my writing that ended up ended up in the book, you know. And I remember when I tried to sell the proposal, people really liked it, but they didn't want to go near it. They said, oh, you know, we're tired of hearing about AIDS now. So, you know, you had Paul Manette's book. You had other, you know, a few other famous writers that wrote about it, but they didn't want to go near there anymore. Right. And now it's kind of resurging, and people are interested in revisiting it again.
I think it's because now there's that distance.
Right. Well, they did Normal Heart on HBO, which was brilliant.
Yes.
Did you see that one?
Yeah.
Oh, God, I just tore me up watching that again after all these years, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so your book is not sad at all, so I don't want to leave on that kind of
note. It's not sad.
No, I was laughing through the book.
Yeah.
Okay, so...
people do cry, but they also laugh a lot, too.
Lewd Nude. You came back from what you called the honeymoon from hell, and you were arrested for prostitution.
Right.
Okay. talk about that story. I love that story.
Oh, my God. Well, I married a gay boy, a bisexual boy, and we went on our honeymoon. He was a nude go-go dancer in the gay bars in West Hollywood, and I was a nude go-go dancer at the time, supplementing my welfare check by a couple nights a week dancing nude at some straight bar. And we went on our honeymoon after having this big hippie wedding on the beach. And, you know, he turned out to be a nightmare. Eric was a very disturbed boy. So on the honeymoon, I discovered I had married the Heartbreak Kid. It was very much like the gay version of that movie, The Heartbreak Kid, when Rodin falls in love with, what's her name, gorgeous actor, Sybil Shepherd, on his honeymoon.
Right.
It was sort of the gay version of that. So when I got back to Venice, I was on the... We had a little section which was kind of an alcove between these two piers that was mostly hidden from the public beach, and we would all go down there and nude sunbathe. And I was lying there by myself naked, and my transsexual friend Ruby, who wasn't a transsexual yet, she was still a boy back then, came by and sat with me, and we're chatting. And the next thing I know, the police are handcuffing me and taking me to jail, saying that I was a prostitute, that I was soliciting, you know. And here I am just sitting with my gay boyfriend.
You were naked in the middle of the city.
Yeah, but there was no law on the book.
Right.
Yeah, so they had to charge us with something else to make it stick. And I found out that day the paddy wagon had swept the beach. They took all the lesbians away over on what we used to call Chi Chi Beach, you know, because all the dykes would go there naked. And then the little area where I was, they put us all in a paddy wagon and took us down to jail. And then when we had our arraignment, you know, the police reports were read, and they were saying that we were all, like, trying to turn tricks on the beach, you know, which was so absurd. You know, it was, like, obvious that even the judge laughed and reprimanded the cops and said, this is ridiculous. You know, you expect me to believe that all these women were out on the beach, you know, trying to turn tricks?
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was that kind of thing. The LAPD was cracking down hard on the gay community or any undesirables that they wanted to get rid of in the 70s because they were trying to, you know, make the area gentrified, you know, for the future,
sure.
Like which it is today, you know.
Because gay people don't do that to a neighborhood, do they?
Right, exactly. I know. It's so crazy. It was so... But back in those days...
In those days, people weren't realizing it. I think we were beginning to realize it then, but but people didn't realize it. Now, where was it? It was somewhere around here that they were advertising. One of the suburbs was advertising for gay people because they wanted to bring up the property values.
Wanted to bring the property values up. Yeah.
Right. You survived the AIDS crisis. You survived a lot of loss. What have you been doing since then?
Well, I've continued to write. I've continued to act a little, not as much as I'd like to. You know, I get a little bit roles here and there. I was on True Blood last week in a scene with Alex Skarsgård, you know, the hot.
Really? Yeah. Awesome.
when you see the scene, I'm completely cut out. I don't see me at all. It's just like a quick shadow of me passing by. I was so upset. But I had such a blast meeting him and working with him because he's such a hot guy, so sweet, you know. But I do a little acting here and there, you know, not very much. I do commercials when I can get them. But I mostly write, and I perform and read with a performance writers group called Queerwise. They're all LGBT seniors over 50, and we have the oldest member is 84. We're doing a show Monday night, actually, at the Spirit Studio in Silver Lake. So we perform about 6 times a year together, our work, and it's under the direction of Michael Kearns. You know Michael? He's a pretty big name in L.A., gay activist, writer, actor, very sweet man.
The name is familiar, and I don't know him.
He was actually on the a memoir out now called The Truth is Bad Enough. You should interview Michael. He is amazing. I mean, he is so active in the community. He's a 30-year-plus AIDS survivor who adopted a black girl when she was abandoned by her crackhead mother in the hospital at birth. He fostered her and then fought to adopt her. She's 19 or 20. She's turning 20 this year. She's in her sophomore year at film school in London. I mean, he's just an amazing girl. Yeah. And he raised her as a single dad. Michael's amazing. He's somebody I should put you in touch with.
What's his last name? Michael
Kearns. Okay. And his book is called The Truth is Bad Enough. He's got more than one book out. He's the guy that wrote The Happy Hustler.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah. He's wonderful. Mm-hmm. He's my mentor, Michael. So I work with Michael's group, and I do other spoken word events around town. You know, mm-hmm. I've even gotten upstage, the oldest person probably on stage at the Moth, telling stories. And, so I keep myself alive.
And working, promoting your daughter's career.
That's true. I do whatever I can because I like to travel and... My daughter's worked overseas a lot in the last 10 years, so I've traveled and visited her and all these Asian kind of. I've been to Vietnam and Hong Kong and China and Malaysia and Singapore. It's kind of fun because whenever she's like working, she's usually staying in a 5-star hotel. Hmm. So I find a way to get over there and crash with her.
That's fun. So you said you're writing another book.
Yeah, it's done, actually. I just got the seal of approval from my editor after the final draft, and I'm getting it all ready, and I'm going to self-publish this one just like I did my first one through Amazon, and CreateSpace, because I can't seem to get the mainstream press to notice me yet.
That's okay.
So, I mean, I actually got – my life actually got to be the number one best-selling memoir of an entertainer for 2 whole days on Amazon. I beat Johnny Carson's book and Billy Crystal's book and all these – because I did a 99-cent promotion on my Kindle book. So my numbers jumped up. But so I'm going to publish the new book, which is sort of picks up where the last book left off, in the 80s after I moved back to L.A., trying to make it in mainstream show business. The book is called Blowjobs, A Guide to Making It in Show Business or Not. And it's about all my war stories of living and working in Hollywood. I used to be Dean Martin's maid. I was his maid for 2 years. I've done a bazillion jobs and businesses. I was a knitter to the stars. I mean, this is all through the 80s and 90s and 2000, all the careers and jobs and everything I've taken just so I wouldn't have to have a straight day job because I wanted to be available for auditions.
Now, I have to tell you, when you just used that word
twice in 1 month,
LaRon is just hysterical. We had a state representative on last week who was talking about our governor and stories that he's heard about him also being involved with men and getting
BJs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh.
So
see, my BJs are not the kind of BJs we think of. The word below job is more in reference to the jobs I've had, the jobs that sucked.
LaRon and I are just hysterical. Our show has been on 30 years. Actually, we're coming up on 31 right now.
Wow, that's amazing.
And, yeah, we're the oldest gay and lesbian radio show on anywhere in the world, as far as we know.
But you found me. That's so cool.
Yeah, in Dallas, Texas, of all places.
Yep.
But we have to say, twice in one in 2 weeks.
Twice
in
2 weeks.
And first time in 30 years. Hopefully our station manager wasn't listening today.
Had blowjobs on your show?
Yeah, we have never discussed that. No.
No.
Oh, my God. Mm-hmm.
So we are just about out of time, Dolores. I want to thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
So fast.
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. My Life, a Four-Letter Word, Dolores DeLuce is the author. It's available on Amazon. Is it in bookstores at all?
It's only in a few small indie stores, but you could go to my website, counterculturediva.com, and you could has a direct link to the Amazon if you can't search it or whatever. Just remember counterculturediva.com, and you can get it in Kindle and paperback on Amazon. That's the best way, probably.
Great.
Yeah.
Thank you, Dolores.
And look for Blowjobs, The Guide to Making It Show Business or Not. That'll be coming out in about a month.
We will look for it.
And
you'll come back in a few months and talk to us about it. We'd love to have you on again.
All right, great. Take care and thank you so much.
Thank you.
I really enjoyed this.
And our guest next week is Jelinski Brown from United Black Element. And that brings us to the end of another Lambda Weekly. We'll be back next week with more.